We're back here looking at the synoptic problem and the two-document theory and whether there is a good alternative to it. The two-document hypothesis is the one that is taught in most evangelical seminaries. It is the theory that you'll find in nearly every evangelical commentary on the Gospels. Not all of them, but most of them. And it is the one that is represented in even most books, most, say, apologetic books, which speak about the age of the Gospels, or how do we know that we've got the Gospels. For example, the book The Case for Christ presupposes Mark and Priority and the Q Theory. Another recent book by Mark D. Roberts called Can We Trust the Gospels? Investigating the Reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John has this to say on page 65. Unfortunately, Luke did not name his written sources. Neither did other evangelists, if indeed they also used written sources. For centuries, scholars have pondered the question of gospel sources. Classically, it was believed that Matthew was the first gospel and that Matthew influenced Mark and Luke. Some scholars still argue for this conclusion. The majority, however, have come to believe that the two-source hypothesis best explains the relationship between the synoptic gospels. That's the one that we'll be critiquing and that we outlined last week, using Robert Stein. And then he says, though I don't have the space to explain the reasons for this schema, I do want to make five quick comments, and then we're going to let him make them. Number one, Q is an abbreviation for Keller, the German word for source. It is a hypothetical document invented to explain the complex relationships among the synoptic gospels. Q is a collection of more than 200 sayings that appear in both Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. Though a few scholars try to explain the existence of these sayings by arguing that Luke used Matthew in addition to Mark, this theory hasn't gained widespread acceptance. 2. The majority of New Testament scholars believe that Matthew used Mark as one of his major sources. Matthew's other sources included Q and M, which is shorthand for Matthean sources. M would contain material that is unique to Matthew, such as the visit of the Magi. There are a few scholars who argue that Matthew wrote first and Mark abridged Matthew, but it's hard to account for the peculiarities of Matthew and Mark according to this scenario. 3. L is shorthand for Lucan sources, which would include, for example, the infancy narratives of Luke. 4. The Gospel of John stands apart from the Synoptic Gospels both in style and some of its content, though similarities between John and the Synoptics abound. And then 5, my guess is that reality was actually more complex than what is depicted in the chart. He's put a chart here of Gospel relationships. L, for example, may have been several documents. Likewise with M, and perhaps even Q. Remember that Luke refers to many written accounts upon which he based his gospel. In the light of Luke's prologue and the nature of the gospels themselves, it seems likely that some framework like the one pictured above accurately reflects the sources for the gospels. Q belongs to the same time period as Mark, given its use by Matthew and Luke, and so on. So we have here in a rather popular, well-written book for the Christian populace, Can We Trust the Gospels by Mark Roberts, a promulgation of the two-document hypothesis. So this is not just in academia. This is what's being taught in The Case for Christ and this book here and other books written for popular audiences. This is what's being taught evangelical readership generally. And so we need to have a good hard look at this, because remember that this view that Matthew copied from Mark and from Q, and maybe he's had his own sources, and then Luke copied from Mark and from Q and then had his sources, this comes from not evangelical scholarship, but it comes from the womb of the Enlightenment. It comes from those who had presuppositions that excluded the supernatural provenance and activity in the Gospels, and who questioned the ancient church's unanimous testimony as to the order of the writing of the Gospels. Now, in Wenham's book, Redating Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he quotes the scholar Petrie from an article in 1959 called Q is Only What You Make It, who expressed the content of Q in a rather humorous way. And I'm going to quote this paragraph that is reprinted in Wenham, page 42. Q is a single document. It is a composite document, incorporating earlier sources. It is used in different redactions. It is more than one document. The original language of Q is Greek. The original language is Aramaic. It is used in different translations. Q is the Matthean Logia. It is not the Matthean Logia. Q has a definite shape. It is no more than an amorphous collection of fragments. Q is a gospel. It is not a gospel. Q includes the crucifixion story. It does not include the crucifixion story. Q consists wholly of sayings, and there is no narrative. It includes some narrative. All of Q is preserved in Matthew and Luke. Not all of it is preserved. It is better preserved in Luke. Matthew's order is the correct order. Luke's is the correct order. Neither order is the correct order. Q is used by Mark. It is not used by Mark. Now, you can see that what Petrie is trying to bring out there is the fact that although the scholars here and those that back the two-document hypothesis like to speak about Q, they can't agree on what Q actually is. Now, you have the liberal scholars, people like John S. Kloppenborg, for example, who believe that they can identify all of the sayings in Q. He's even published a book purporting to be the document Q. But for those who are less inclined to believe and build a career upon the understanding of what Q is, there are these tremendous disagreements. Now, Linneman has shown that even though many of these scholars like to say that Q is just a sayings source, that also it actually is supposed to include many of the accounts of Jesus' works. And if that's the case, then, you know, what exactly is Q? Is it a gospel itself, including the works and sayings of Christ? Or is it just a logion? Is it just a saying source, something like the Gospel of Thomas, which just has sayings of Jesus? Now, by the way, I use the term logion because that is the term that is often used for it, but I'm going to correct, I think, some misapprehensions on what Papias particularly meant when he used the term logion in relation to Matthew's Gospel a little bit later on. Now, what Linneman brings out, if Q is a saying source, she says, if you actually look at what these sayings are, if you divide them out and you look at the length of them, hardly any of them are any longer than Psalm 23. In fact, most of them are shorter than Psalm 23, but how many of us can recite Psalm 23 by heart? Even today, when there's not a lot of emphasis on mnemonics, there's not a lot of emphasis on memorization and oral transmission. Everything is through the written word or recorded. And then she points to the fact that back in ancient Israel, oral transmission was the major way of transferring a person's teachings. And we know that to be true. We'll look at that more again later on. And last time I gave the example of the Waldensians and how the Waldensian pastors were expected to memorize the whole of the New Testament. That was just expected of them. It's a good job that's not a qualification for being a pastor today, because there wouldn't be very many pastors in the world. But what's important to realize here is that oral transmission, if you have a culture that encourages it and believes in it, is certainly capable of memorizing many of the sayings of Jesus, providing they're not long accounts. For the longer accounts, the Olivet Discourse, for example, Matthew 24 and 25, Mark 13, Luke 21, or the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 through 7, Luke 6, if you believe it's the same time. There are many people that can memorize these sayings very easily. And you couple that with the fact that Jesus seemed to adopt a way of speaking that was memorable, using figures, using catchphrases, a poetic meter that was easy to be memorized. Well, then we have to at least, even on that very basic understanding of what we meet in the Gospels, we have to say, well, look, is Mark and priority and the Q theory even necessary as an explanation? Is it too overdone? Is it too scientific? Does it scrutinize too much? And by scrutinizing too much, is it missing the wood for the trees? And I think there is a case that can be made for just that belief. Now, going back to Stein's essay, which is a very good essay that we interacted with last week, I want to today try to go back to what he says and to come at it maybe in a different way. Now, we cannot be all technical. We can't write a book on this. We're not going to spend a whole course on the interactions. So you're going to have to do some of this work yourself. And I've put some of the documents on the website so that you can at least have a look at the other side. It's not difficult to find those that support the Q theory and the two-document theory. So I've not put any of those on. Why? Well, because you just pick up a book on New Testament Introduction, Even Jesus and the Gospels by Blomberg, and you're going to find it. You're going to run into it all the time. So what I'm interested in doing is showing you that, hey, there is another side to the story. There is another way of interpreting this. And I should say this, the opposition to the two-document theory is growing, and it's particularly growing through researches that is happening in Britain. People like N.T. Wright, who is a major influence in New Testament studies, a little bit liberal, yes, but has done some very important work. He does not accept the Q theory. And James Dunn, another evangelical liberal or liberal evangelical, he at least questions a lot of what has been said about oral transmission. And so a lot of work is being done to say, well, hold on a minute, I think we've come to the wrong conclusions, and maybe we've not answered our questions in the right way here. Well, let's see. Going to Stein's essay on the synoptic problem in the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels, and concentrating on what he says here about the two-document hypothesis. He says, quote, "This theory argues that Mark was the first gospel written and that it was used independently by Matthew and Luke. It also argues that, along with Mark, Matthew and Luke used another common source that has been called Q. Evidence for the priority of Mark and the existence of Q are as follows." And then he says, first, "Mark is the shortest gospel." And he asks, "Is it not easier to understand Matthew and Luke using Mark and choosing to add additional materials to it than to think of Mark using Matthew, Luke, or both, and deciding to omit so much material?" Well, the fact of the matter is, that might seem to be a good argument. Mark is the kind of the raw material gospel. Matthew comes to Mark and he decides to add the Sermon on the Mount. And he decides to add parables, for example, in Matthew 13 and other teachings. He decides to work on the Greek of Mark, because one of the other things that he's going to say here and that they always say is that Mark's Greek is not so good. So Matthew's going to make his Greek better, you see. And it's easier to understand that Matthew is going to improve, quote unquote, on Mark's gospel than to say that Mark is aware of Matthew's gospel, which is superior in these areas and the things that it reports. And why, therefore, didn't Mark include these things if they were on hand? Well, let's try and look at it a different way. Maybe Matthew wrote first and there was no need for Mark to include the Sermon on the Mount and these the parables and these other things. Maybe Mark's account presupposed that the Matthean account was already known, and therefore there would be no need to record these things. But what Mark did want to address was another eyewitness account to what Jesus did. Now, church history and tradition is almost unanimous on the fact that Mark, in fact it is unanimous, that Mark was the companion of Peter, and that Peter either dictated to Mark, or that Mark, after the departure of Peter, he uses the term, the ancient sources usually use the term exodus, which is a strange term for death, which it could be used for death. But either Mark, after the death of Peter in about AD 62, wrote the preaching of Peter down for the sake of the Church of Rome, which is a very literate and literary society, or that after Peter left Rome at around AD 44, that Mark wrote down, again, the preaching, the sayings of Peter. Now, there seems to be very strong contention that the latter of those is the case. And we can't go into all of the evidence here. If you can get hold of the Bampton lectures, you might be able to get hold of these online. I haven't checked. Yeah, Edmondson's Bampton lectures of 1913, called The Church in Rome in the First Century. Then a very strong argument is brought forward that is used by Wenham for the fact that Mark is writing down Peter's usual preaching, usual accounts of his experiences in the time of Jesus and the memories that he has at around about AD 43-44. And if that is the case, then Mark is not interested, first and foremost, in what Matthew has said. Now, he may know Matthew. In fact, there seems to be good reason to say that he did know Matthew. But Mark is primarily concerned to write the story of Peter and the preaching of Peter. Now, this accounts for some interesting phenomena. First of all, it accounts for the Greek, because the Greek of Mark is much more of a conversational kind of Greek. It's not a literate Greek. And Peter was a fisherman. And so if he's copying down, basically, or transcribing what he heard from Peter, then that accounts for the style that's being used. It also accounts for the vividness. Now, one of the other things that Stein brings out here is that there are what he calls harder readings, and there are redundancies, as he calls them, in Mark's account. For example, where Mark has, "when evening came as the sun was setting," and other such things. Well, these redundancies fit much more easily into an eyewitness account. In other words, if we have expansions of certain accounts in Mark over against what we find in Matthew and Luke, these can be explained not as Matthew and Luke coming to these fuller accounts of Mark and editing them, redacting them, and giving their own twist to them, but just the fact that this is Peter's preaching. This is Peter's account. Again, we find here Stein saying that the suggestion that Mark may have desired to produce a shorter, more abridged account stumbles over the fact that the common accounts in the Synoptic Gospels are generally longer in Mark. If Mark wanted to write an abbreviated account of Matthew and or Luke, why would he choose to make the stories in his abridged account longer. And of course, that begs the question. We're not saying that Mark is an abridged account. We're saying that Mark is Peter's account. And that does the job of accounting for that supposed redundancy there. In Wenham, he makes, I think, an important point that has often not been made. He says, ultimately, the acceptability of redaction theories, remember, redaction theories are the evangelists editing Mark's material and Q's material, trimming it to their own desires. The acceptability of redaction theories will turn on what we think of the evangelists and their aims. If we believe that they were well-informed, anxious to pass on their story in accordance with the apostolic tradition, we shall be skeptical of theories which allow great scope to the evangelist to modify and transpose his source material and to create new material to serve his purposes. Page 54. Now, this is a key element that has not often been thought through very well, I don't think. You see, Wenham makes the point here that if we just presuppose for a minute that Matthew is copying from Mark and that Luke is copying from Mark. Now, let's just presuppose that. Then we see that if we just look at the places in the Synoptic Gospels where one Gospel seems to know another Gospel, there's pretty good evidence that Luke definitely knows Mark. He follows his order all the time. In fact, the 72 pericopes, individual sayings or passages in Luke's Gospel where he follows the order of Mark exactly. And so he seems to be basing his Gospel on the order of Mark's Gospel. Now, in those accounts, we can see that Luke will not diverge from the sense which Mark gives to that account or that saying. Now, he does differ in the way that it's recorded, which means that he's not wholly relying on Mark. But as far as the order that he's following, he does seem to be following Mark. Let me say that again. Luke seems to be following the order of Mark. So he seems to have studied Mark's gospel and say, well, I'm going to follow the order that Mark has set out here, following Peter's account. But he has a lot of his own materials, and he's going to fit his own materials into that order. So it's going to look very similar to Mark's account, but it's going to be different from Mark's account as well. And we see the same thing where if we say that Mark follows Matthew, or indeed Matthew, if we want, follows Mark, just presupposing that for a minute, we see again that Matthew is very concerned to stay close to Mark, or Mark is very concerned to stay very close to Matthew as far as the order and the sense of the teaching is concerned. Now, if that is the case, what we can say is, let's just look at Luke, that Luke, as he says in his prologue, is concerned for accuracy. He's concerned not to change, not to edit, not to redact, not to embellish the materials. He wants to report them faithfully. And Matthew seems to be of the same way, if we assume that he's copying from Mark. Now, if he's not, he still seems to be concerned with reporting the truth. Mark also. Remember that the two document hypothesis has Matthew, for example, you know, I know they don't like to use this word, but he is deceiving us by saying that Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount at the time that he did. Remember that the Sermon on the Mount is an inclusio. That is, that the Sermon on the Mount has a particular beginning where Jesus is going up the hill to his disciples, and he's seated, and he talks to them, he preaches to them. And at the end of that inclusio, we have when Jesus had finished these sayings, at the end of chapter 7, the crowds who had evidently come up the hill during the time that he was preaching, said that he spoke with one of authority. We have the whole of the sermon framed within a particular life setting. Now, if Jesus did not preach the Sermon on the Mount, then Matthew must have put those life settings in there. He must have deceived us. You say, well, he didn't think he was deceiving us. I don't care what he thought. The fact of the matter is, whether he thought he was deceiving us or not, the Holy Spirit certainly was deceiving us. Because that did not happen the way that it is recorded as happening. Now, if we say that these three evangelists were concerned to be truthful and conspicuously honest with their sources and to follow them, then we don't need to start saying, like Stein does, that, for example, Matthew makes some kind of error, some kind of mistake. If we recall last week, I think I read out here, that Matthew has sought to change the wording of Mark and has, by changing the verb baptized to the participle having been baptized, mistakenly placed the word immediately with the verb went up. You see, once you go down the road of the two-document theory, you have to start saying that Matthew and Luke invented stuff, that they made mistakes, that they deceived, that they embellished. Well, I'm sorry, I don't believe that. As a Bible believer, as someone who holds the presupposition of the absolute and ultimate authority of the Word of God, I cannot go down that road, because that road is not a road that I believe the Bible allows me to go down. The Bible tells me that I must assume its authority and its truth at every turn. Now, if I don't understand how things weave together, then I take it on faith that I don't have to know, but there is an explanation. And if I start to rethink things, not in terms of enlightenment thinking, but in terms of how it could have come about, I think that I'm duty-bound to take that road. I'm duty-bound to take the harmonistic road. And I'm also duty-bound to believe the early testimony of the fathers when they say that Matthew wrote first, Mark wrote second, and Luke wrote third. Now, having said that, let's look at what Wenham says in response to some of these arguments that Stein brings up. Firstly, on page 20 of his book, Wenham says, "It cannot be too strongly stated that one evangelist's knowledge of the work of another does not necessarily mean that his work is a modification of the other." Now, he brings out reasons for that later on in his book, and we'll be looking at that in the next lecture. But it's important to grasp that just because Luke has Mark's gospel and has studied Mark's gospel doesn't mean that he is copying Mark's gospel and then embellishing or changing or editing it. In fact, as we will show, there is every reason to believe that he's not doing that. First of all, from his prologue, and secondly, because of the great difficulty of doing that with a big scroll. That is not the way the ancients worked. They would not have a huge scroll in front of them, which they are going back and forward to, comparing, and then changing on their manuscript. The very process of that goes against what we know of ancient copyists and ancient scholars, and it would have been a very, very difficult thing to do. Now, if we take into account the fact that Luke had his own sources, then he doesn't need to do that, does he? He just needs Mark as one of his sources, and he just needs Mark to base his order on, which it seems that he does. Again, let me remind you that Luke, although he certainly is different to Mark in his accounts, and he uses some different languages, and his reports do differ, yet they do not differ in sense from Mark's account, especially when dealing with the words of Jesus. So that's the first thing that we have to make sure that we understand. Just because a person might know the work of another doesn't mean that they're modifying it. Now, secondly, if Luke got some of his material from a very early source, for example, like one of the 70 that was sent out by Jesus, then wouldn't that account for much of, for example, his central section, which is unique to him, and for his different accounts of what is in the Markan material? We need to consider that, because Luke says that other accounts have been written and that he has looked into these other accounts when he's writing to Theophilus. We know from the researches of people like Colin Hamer and others, and William Ramsey, that Luke was an extremely good historian and a careful historian. We know, as we've just said, by comparing Luke's account with Mark's account, that Luke is concerned not to deviate from Mark's sense and his meaning. Now, that being the case, it is not beyond possibility at all that Luke sought out and knew some of the original 70 that were sent out by Jesus, and it was the accounts of those that he is reporting. In fact, there are some people that believe that Luke himself was one of the 70. We don't have to assume that, but it's a possibility. Why shouldn't that be true? But what we're assuming here is that Luke knew some of the 70, and if he did, then we don't need Luke redacting Mark. We just need Luke having another alternative account to Mark, which is similar to Mark's. Now, on pages 78 and 79, Wenham makes this point. He says, "The 12 played an important part not only in the leadership of the early church, but also in its constitution and thought. The 70, on the other hand, seem to have no permanent importance in the structure of the church. Yet, Luke deals with the mission of the 12 in 6 verses, chapter 9, verses 1 through 6, and then proceeds to devote 24 verses, chapter 10, verses 1 through 24, to tell of the appointment, instruction, dispatch, and return of the 70, and of the subsequent disclosures to them. He enters into considerable and intimate detail. He, quote, sent them on ahead of him, two by two, into every town and place where he himself was about to come, end quote. And when they returned, quote, with joy, end quote, Jesus told them of his own experience of seeing Satan fall from heaven. He then, quote, exulted in the Holy Spirit and turned to his disciples and spoke to them privately. It is true that the instructions to the 70 have much in common with those to the 12, but this need not mean borrowing, since not only is it intrinsically probable that the instructions would be similar, but there are also many differences between them to be accounted for. This otherwise strange phenomenon would be explained if the narrative concerning the 70 stood almost at the beginning of the records of one who took part in that mission and stayed with Jesus until the end. It would supply a gap in the church's knowledge of Jesus' ministry, and it would reinforce and add to its knowledge of this teaching." What Wenham is saying is that if Luke knows one of the 70, or if he perhaps was one of the 70, that would account for the fact that he gives so much prominence to the sending out of the 70 and seems to know so much detail about the 70, who were not particularly important, you know, after that time, told very much about them at all. Now, he goes on and says on page 79 that if Luke had such an informant, one of the 70, he would have been well informed about earlier stages of the ministry, since any man chosen for this mission work must have been around long enough to show his mettle. And it is likely that he would also have been with Jesus in the final stages of the ministry after the journeyings which brought them eventually to Jerusalem. So, when we figure that out, then we have Luke sticking to Mark, but also having his own early sources. On pages 89 and 90, Wenham says, quote, "So often reasons purporting to support a given redactional view are simply possible reasons which might have influenced a redactor if there was a redactor, which has yet to be proved." And he says, "We must take care to see whether in fact those lines of evidence for Mark and Priority really support it, or whether they simply prove he wrote second." And this is the thing. On a number of occasions, he says, these lines of evidence actually don't really prove Mark and Priority. They suppose Mark and Priority. But they really are only proving that Mark wrote second, that Luke knew Mark. They're not actually proving that Matthew is copying from Mark. And many of the arguments are reversible, and therefore they're of no great value in settling the question. Now, on pages 85 and 86 of this book, again, I want to give you the material that Wenham has, because this book's a hard book to get hold of and it's very expensive. So I want to share what I can of it with you. Wenham writes, under the subheading, "Did Matthew and Luke innovate?" That is, did they act as freelance editors here? He says, quote, "It is thus clear that, just as Luke would not have altered a Q of the Matthean type in the way supposed," because he's very careful with his sources, "neither would Matthew have done so to one of the Lucan type. That both Matthew and Luke would have made major changes sufficient to account for the divergences between the two known versions of the Q material is of precisely equal improbability. For, if Luke made X changes and Matthew made Y, the result would be the same if all the X plus Y changes had been made by one of them. In other words, Luke's known use of Mark and Matthew's supposed use of it render the Q hypothesis, whether regarded as a single or multiple source, improbable." And then under the heading of "Did Luke use Matthew?" he says, "Finally, we must consider the possibility that Luke got his Q material direct from Matthew. In this case, the Q hypothesis is ruled out, since the Matthean Q material is simply Matthean material. We have already seen," he says, "that attempts to find a common order of Q material in Luke and Matthew have failed to convince. Equally, no argument can be based on the wording. Luke cannot have gotten his main Q material from Matthew, since this would have entailed changing the sense of his source in a manner belied by his known fidelity to Mark." And then he says a bit further down, "The picture which is emerging would suggest that Luke had two documents which are known to us, which he used quite differently, but equally scrupulously. He took Mark as his guide to the basic framework of the gospel. Following the order and main substance of Mark's pericopes in the first third and final third of his book, though seldom following its actual wording. Matthew he seems to have used in a minor way to provide some supplementary information in the early part of the book. That he used so little of Matthew would not be surprising, if Luke intended his gospel to supplement rather than to replace the earlier work, and B, if he was hard pressed for space. In addition, he had a great quantity of new material, not only the commonly recognized L material, but a different account of the great sermon and the healing of the centurion's boy, and the whole central section and the parable of the pounds, and he probably had his own version of the eschatological discourse and the passion narrative prior to his final composition of the gospel. This is tantamount to a great enlargement of the category special Luke." End quote. In other words, what he's saying is, Luke had his own sources. He had a lot of his own material that he was relying on, and he just used the order of Mark without changing the sense, as we've said, and then knew Matthew and included some of Matthew's material to help him, particularly in the early part of the gospel, but did not see the need to import whole new Matthean account into his gospel because he didn't have room for it and he had so much material that he could put in himself, alternative accounts. Well, we have to stop there for this lecture, but we're going to go on to look at the relation of Matthew to Mark, which is one of the key issues in this whole two-document theory.